The Return of the King, Disc 9.
So the desperate journey went on, as the ring went south and the banners of the kings rode north. For the hobbits each day, each mile, was more bitter than the one before, as their strength lessened and the land became more evil. They met no enemies by day. At times by night, as they cowered or drowsed uneasily in some hiding beside the road, they heard cries and the noise of many feet, or the swift passing of some cruelly ridden steed. But far worse than all such perils was the ever-approaching threat that beat upon them as they went, the dreadful menace of the power that waited, brooding in deep thought and sleepless malice, behind the dark veils about its throne. Nearer and nearer it drew, looming blacker, like the oncoming of a wall of night at the last end of the world. There came at last a dreadful nightfall, and even as the captains of the West drew near to the end of their living lands, the two wanderers came to an hour of blank despair. 4 days had passed since they had escaped from the Orcs, but the time lay behind them like an ever-darkening dream. All this last day Frodo had not spoken, but had walked half-bowed, often stumbling, as if his eyes no longer saw the way before his feet. Sam guessed that among all their pains he bore the worst, the growing weight of the ring, a burden on the body and a torment to his mind. Anxiously Sam had noted how his master's left hand would often be raised as if to ward off a blow, or to screen his shrinking eyes from a dreadful eye that sought to look in them. And sometimes his right hand would creep to his breast, clutching, and then slowly, as the will recovered mastery, it would be withdrawn. Now, as the blackness of night returned, Frodo sat, his head between his knees, his arms hanging wearily to the ground where his hands lay feebly twitching. Sam watched him, till night covered them both and hid them from one another. He could no longer find any words to say, and he turned to his own dark thoughts. As for himself, though weary and under a shadow of fear, he still had some strength left. The Lembas had a virtue, without which they would long ago have lain down to die. It did not satisfy desire, and at times Sam's mind was filled with the memories of food and the longing for simple bread and meats. And yet this waybread of the elves had a potency that increased as travellers relied on it alone and did not mingle it with other foods. It fed the will, and it gave strength to endure, and to master sinew and limb beyond the measure of mortal kind. But now a new decision must be made. They could not follow this road any longer, for it went on eastward into the great shadow. But the mountain now loomed upon their right, almost due south, and they must turn towards it. Yet still before it there stretched a wide region of fuming, barren, ash-ridden land. "Water, water," muttered Sam. He had stinted himself, and in his parched mouth his tongue seemed thick and swollen. But for all his care, they now had very little, perhaps half his bottle, and maybe there were still days to go. All would long ago have been spent, if they had not dared to follow the Orc Road. For at long intervals on that highway, cisterns had been built for the use of troops sent in haste through the waterless regions. In one, Sam had found some water left, stale, muddied by the Orcs, but still sufficient for their desperate case. Yet that was now a day ago. There was no hope of any more. At last, wearied with his cares, Sam drowsed, leaving the morrow till it came. He could do no more. Dream and waking mingled uneasily. He saw lights like gloating eyes, and dark creeping shapes, and he heard noises as of wild beasts, or the dreadful cries of tortured things, and he would start up to find the world all dark and only empty blackness all about him. Once only, as he stood and stared wildly round, did it seem that, though now awake, he could still see pale lights like eyes, but soon they flickered and vanished. The hateful night passed slowly and reluctantly. Such daylight as followed was dim. For here, as the mountain drew near, the air was ever murky, while out from the dark tower there crept the veils of shadow that Sauron wove about himself. Frodo was lying on his back, not moving. Sam stood beside him, reluctant to speak, and yet knowing that the word now lay with him. He must set his master's will to work for another effort. At length, stooping and caressing Frodo's brow, he spoke in his ear. "Wake up, master," he said. "Time for another start." As if roused by a sudden bell, Frodo rose quickly and stood up and looked away southwards. But when his eyes beheld the mountain and the desert, he quailed again. "I can't manage it, Sam," he said. "It's such a weight to carry, such a weight." Sam knew before he spoke that it was vain, and that such words might do more harm than good, but in his pity he could not keep silent. "Then let me carry it a bit for you, master," he said. "You know I would, and gladly, as long as I have any strength." A wild light came into Frodo's eyes. "Stand away! Don't touch me!" he cried. "It is mine, I say. Be off!" His hand strayed to his sword hilt. But then quickly his voice changed. "No, no, Sam," he said sadly. "But you must understand, it is my burden, and no one else can bear it. It's too late now, Sam dear. You can't help me in that way again. I'm almost in its power now. I could not give it up, and if you tried to take it, I should go mad." Sam nodded. "I understand," he said. "But I've been thinking, Mr. Frodo, there's other things we might do without. Why not lighten the load a bit? We're going that way now, as straight as we can make it." He pointed to the mountain. "It's no good taking anything we're not sure to need." Frodo looked again towards the mountain. "No," he said, "we shan't need much on that road, and at its end nothing." Picking up his orc shield, he flung it away and threw his helmet after it. Then, pulling off the grey cloak, he undid the heavy belt and let it fall to the ground, and the sheathed sword with it. The threads of the black cloak he tore off and scattered. "There, I'll be an orc no more," he cried, "and I'll bear no weapon, fair or foul. Let them take me if they will." Sam did likewise, and put aside his orc gear, and he took out all the things in his pack. Somehow each of them had become dear to him, if only because he had borne them so far with so much toil. Hardest of all to part with was his cooking gear. Tears welled in his eyes at the thought of casting it away. "Do you remember that bit of rabbit, Mr. Frodo?" he said. "And our place under the warm bank in Captain Faramir's country, the day I saw an Olifant?" "No, I'm afraid not, Sam," said Frodo. "At least I know that such things happened. But I can't see them. No taste of food, no feel of water, no sound of wind, no memory of tree or grass or flower, no image of moon or star are left to me. I'm naked in the dark, Sam, and there's no veil between me and the Wheel of Fire. I begin to see it even with my waking eyes, and all else fades." Sam went to him and kissed his hand.
"Then the sooner we're rid of it, the sooner to rest," he said haltingly, finding no better words to say. "Talking won't mend nothing," he muttered to himself, as he gathered up all the things that they had chosen to cast away. He was not willing to leave them lying open in the wilderness for any eyes to see. "Stinker picked up that orc shirt, seemingly, and he isn't going to add a sword to it. His hands are bad enough when empty, and he isn't going to mess with my pans." With that he carried all the gear away to one of the many gaping fissures that scored the land and threw them in. The clatter of his precious pans as they fell down into the dark was like a death knell to his heart. He came back to Frodo, and then, of his elven rope, he cut a short piece to serve his master as a girdle and bind the grey cloak close about his waist. The rest he carefully coiled and put back in his pack.
Beside that, he kept only the remnants of their whey bread and the water bottle, and Sting still hanging by his belt. And hidden away in a pocket of his tunic next his breast, the file of Galadriel, and the little box that she gave him for his own. Now at last they turned their faces to the mountain and set out, thinking no more of concealment, bending their weariness and failing wills only to the one task of going on. In the dimness of its dreary day, few things even in that land of vigilance could have espied them, save from close at hand. Of all the slaves of the Dark Lord, only the Nazgul could have warned him of the peril that crept, small but indomitable, into the very heart of his guarded realm. But the Nazgul and their black wings were abroad on another errand. They were gathered far away, shadowing the march of the captains of the West, and thither the thought of the Dark Tower was turned. That day it seemed to Sam that his master had found some new strength, more than could be explained by the small lightening of the load that he had to carry. In the first marches, they went further and faster than he had hoped. The land was rough and hostile, and yet they made much progress, and even the mountain drew nearer. But as the day wore on, and all too soon the dim light began to fail, Frodo stooped again and began to stagger, as if the renewed effort had squandered his remaining strength. At their last halt he sank down and said, "I'm thirsty, Sam," and didn't speak again. Sam gave him a mouthful of water. Only one more mouthful remained. He went without himself, and now, as once more the night of Mordor closed over him, through all his thoughts there came the memory of water, and every brook or stream or fount that he had ever seen, under green willow shades or twinkling in the sun, danced and rippled for his torment behind the blindness of his eyes. He felt the cool mud about his toes as he paddled in the pool at Bywater with Jolly Cotton and Tom and Nibs and their sister Rosie. "But that was years ago," he sighed, "and far away. The way back, if there is one, goes past the mountain." He couldn't sleep, and he held a debate with himself. "Well, come now. We've done better than you hoped," he said sturdily. "Begun well, anyway. I reckon we crossed half the distance before we stopped. One more day will do it." And then he paused. "Don't be a fool, Sam Gamgee," came an answer in his own voice. "He won't go another day like that if he moves at all, and you can't go on much longer giving him all the water and most of the food." "I can go on a good way, though, and I will." "Where to?" "To the mountain, of course." "But what then, Sam Gamgee? What then? When you get there, what are you going to do? He won't be able to do anything for himself." To his dismay, Sam realized that he had not got an answer to this. He had no clear idea at all. Frodo had not spoken much to him of his errand, and Sam only knew vaguely that the ring had somehow to be put into the fire. "The Cracks of Doom," he muttered, the old name rising to his mind. "Well, if Master knows how to find them, I don't." "There you are," came the answer. "It's all quite useless. He said so himself. You're the fool going on hoping and toiling. You could have lain down and gone to sleep together days ago if you hadn't been so dogged. But you'll die just the same, or worse. You might just as well lie down now and give it up. You'll never get to the top anyway."
"I'll get there, if I leave everything but my bones behind," said Sam. "And I'll carry Mr. Frodo up myself if it breaks my back and heart. So stop arguing."
At that moment Sam felt a tremor in the ground beneath him, and he heard or sensed a deep remote rumble as of thunder imprisoned under the earth. There was a brief red flame that flickered under the clouds and died away. The mountain, too, slept uneasily. The last stage of their journey to Orodruin came, and it was a torment greater than Sam had ever thought that he could bear. He was in pain, and so parched that he could no longer swallow even a mouthful of food. It remained dark.
not only because of the smokes of the mountain. There seemed to be a storm coming up, and away to the southeast there was a shimmer of lightnings under the black skies. Worst of all, the air was full of fumes, breathing was painful and difficult, and a dizziness came on them, so that they staggered and often fell, and yet their wills did not yield, and they struggled on. The mountain crept up ever nearer, until, if they lifted their heavy heads, it filled all their sight, looming vast before them, a huge mass of ash and slag and burned stone, out of which a sheer-sided cone was raised into the clouds. Before the day-long dusk ended and true night came again, they had crawled and stumbled to its very feet. With a gasp, Frodo cast himself on the ground. Sam sat by him. To his surprise, he felt tired but lighter, and his head seemed clear again. No more debates disturbed his mind. He knew all the arguments of despair and would not listen to them. His will was set, and only death would break it. He felt no longer either desire or need of sleep, but rather of watchfulness. He knew that all the hazards and perils were now drawing together to a point. The next day would be a day of doom, the day of final effort or disaster, the last gasp. But when would it come? The night seemed endless and timeless, minute after minute falling dead and adding up to no passing hour, bringing no change. Sam began to wonder if a second darkness had begun, and no day would ever reappear. At last he groped for Frodo's hand. It was cold and trembling. His master was shivering. "I didn't ought to have left my blanket behind," muttered Sam, and lying down he tried to comfort Frodo with his arms and body. Then sleep took him, and the dim light of the last day of their quest found them side by side. The wind had fallen the day before, as it shifted from the west, and now it came from the north and began to rise, and slowly the light of the unseen sun filtered down into the shadows where the hobbits lay. "Now for it, now for the last gasp," said Sam as he struggled to his feet. He bent over Frodo, rousing him gently. Frodo groaned, but with a great effort of will he staggered up, and then he fell upon his knees again. He raised his eyes with difficulty to the dark slopes of Mount Doom towering above him, and then pitifully he began to crawl forward on his hands. Sam looked at him and wept in his heart, but no tears came to his dry and stinging eyes. "I said I'd carry him if it broke my back," he muttered, "and I will." "Come, Mr. Frodo," he cried, "I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you and it as well. So up you get. Come on, Mr. Frodo, dear. Sam will give you a ride. Just tell him where to go, and he'll go." As Frodo clung upon his back, arms loosely about his neck, legs clasped firmly under his arms, Sam staggered to his feet, and then, to his amazement, he felt the burden light. He'd feared that he would have barely strength to lift his master alone, and beyond that he had expected to share in the dreadful dragging weight of the accursed ring. But it was not so. Whether because Frodo was so worn by his long pains, wound of knife, and venomous sting, and sorrow, fear, and homeless wandering, or because some gift of final strength was given to him, Sam lifted Frodo with no more difficulty than if he were carrying a hobbit child pick-a-back in some romp on the lawns or hayfields of the Shire. He took a deep breath and started off. They'd reached the mountain's foot on its northern side, and a little to the westward. There its long grey slopes, though broken, were not sheer. Frodo didn't speak, and so Sam struggled on as best he could, having no guidance but the will to climb as high as might be before his strength gave out and his will broke. On he toiled, up and up, turning this way and that to lessen the slope, often stumbling forward, and at the last crawling like a snail with a heavy burden on its back. When his will could drive him no further, and his limbs gave way, he stopped and laid his master gently down. Frodo opened his eyes and drew a breath. It was easier to breathe up here, above the reeks that coiled and drifted down below. "Thank you, Sam," he said in a cracked whisper. "How far is there to go?"
"I don't know," said Sam, "because I don't know where we're going."
He looked back, and then he looked up, and he was amazed to see how far his last effort had brought him. The mountain, standing ominous and alone, had looked taller than it was. Sam saw now that it was less lofty than the high passes of the FL Dueth, which he and Frodo had scaled. The confused and tumbled shoulders of its great base rose for maybe 3,000 feet above the plains, and above them was reared half as high again its tall central cone, like a vast oast or chimney capped with a jagged crater. But already Sam was more than halfway up the base, and the plain of Gorgoroth was dim below him, wrapped in fume and shadow. As he looked up, he would have given a shout, if his parched throat had allowed him, for amid the rugged humps and shoulders above him he saw plainly a path or road. It climbed like a rising girdle from the west, and wound snake-like about the mountain, until before it went round out of view, it reached the foot of the cone upon its eastern side. Sam could not see the course immediately above him, where it was lowest, for a steep slope went up from where he stood. But he guessed that if he could only struggle on just a little way further up, they would strike this path. A gleam of hope returned to him. They might conquer the mountain yet. "Why, it might have been put there a purpose," he said to himself. "If it wasn't there, I'd have to say I was beaten in the end." The path was not put there for the purposes of Sam. He didn't know it, but he was looking at Sauron's road from Barad-dûr to the Samarth-nar, the Chambers of Fire. Out from the Dark Tower's huge western gate it came, over a deep abyss, by a vast bridge of iron, and then, passing into the plain, it ran for a league between two smoking chasms, and so reached a long sloping causeway that led up on to the mountain's eastern side. Thence, turning and encircling all its wide girth from south to north, it climbed at last, high in the upper cone, but still far from the reeking summit, to a dark entrance that gazed back east, straight to the window of the eye in Sauron's shadow-mantled fortress. Often blocked or destroyed by the tumults of the mountain's furnaces, always that road was repaired and cleaned again by the labours of countless orcs. Sam drew a deep breath. There was a path, but how he was to get up the slope to it he did not know. First he must ease his aching back. He lay flat beside Frodo for a while. Neither spoke. Slowly the light grew. Suddenly a sense of urgency, which he didn't understand, came to Sam. It was almost as if he had been called. Now, or it'll be too late. He braced himself and got up. Frodo also seemed to have felt the call. He struggled to his knees. "I'll crawl, Sam," he gasped. So foot by foot, like small grey insects, they crept up the slope. They came to the path and found that it was broad, paved with broken rubble and beaten ash. Frodo clambered onto it, and then moved as if by some compulsion, he turned slowly to face the east. Far off the shadows of Sauron hung, but torn by some gust of wind out of the world, or else moved by some great disquiet within, the mantling cloud swirled, and for a moment drew aside, and then he saw, rising black, blacker and darker than the vast shades amid which it stood, the cruel pinnacles and iron crown of the topmost tower of Barad-dûr. One moment only it stared out, but as from some great window immeasurably high there stabbed northward a flame of red, the flicker of a piercing eye, and then the shadows were furled again and the terrible vision was removed. The eye was not turned to them. It was gazing north, to where the captains of the west stood at bay, and thither all its malice was now bent, as the power moved to strike its deadly blow. But Frodo, at that dreadful glimpse, fell as one stricken mortally. His hand sought the chain about his neck. Sam knelt by him. Faint, almost inaudibly, he heard Frodo whispering, "Help me, Sam. Help me, Sam.
Hold my hand. I can't stop it.
Sam took his master's hands and laid them together, palm to palm, and kissed them. And then he held them gently between his own. The thought came suddenly to him.
He's spotted us. It's all up, or it soon will be. Now, Sam Gamgee, this is the end of ends.
Again he lifted Frodo and drew his hands down to his own breast, letting his master's legs dangle. Then he bowed his head and struggled off along the climbing road. It was not as easy a way to take as it had looked at first. By fortune the fires that had poured forth in the great turmoils when Sam stood upon Kirithungol had flowed down mainly on the southern and western slopes, and the road on this side was not blocked. Yet in many places it had crumbled away, or was crossed by gaping rents. After climbing eastward for some time, it bent back upon itself at a sharp angle, and went westward for a space. There at the bend it was cut deep through a crag of old weathered stone once long ago vomited from the mountain's furnaces. Panting under his load, Sam turned the bend, and even as he did so, out of the corner of his eye, he had a glimpse of something falling from the crag, like a small piece of black stone that had toppled off as he passed. A sudden weight smote him, and he crashed forward, tearing the backs of his hands that still clasped his master's. Then he knew what had happened, for above him, as he lay, he heard a hated voice.
"Wicked master!" it hissed. "Wicked master cheats us! Cheats Smeagol! Come! He mustn't go that way! He mustn't hurt Precious! Give it to Smeagol! Yes, give it to us! Give it to us!"
With a violent heave, Sam rose up. At once he drew his sword, but he could do nothing. Gollum and Frodo were locked together. Gollum was tearing at his master, trying to get at the chain and the ring. This was probably the only thing that could have roused the dying embers of Frodo's heart and will. An attack, an attempt to wrest his treasure from him by force. He fought back with a sudden fury that amazed Sam, and Gollum also. Even so, things might have gone far otherwise, if Gollum himself had remained unchanged. But whatever dreadful paths, lonely and hungry and waterless, he had trodden, driven by a devouring desire and a terrible fear, they had left grievous marks on him. He was a lean, starved, haggard thing, all bones and tight-drawn sallow skin. A wild light flamed in his eyes, but his malice was no longer matched by his old griping strength. Frodo flung him off and rose up quivering.
"Down! Down!"
he gasped, clutching his hand to his breast, so that beneath the cover of his leather shirt he clasped the ring.
"Down, you creeping thing, and out of my path! Your time is at an end. You cannot betray me or slay me now!"
Then suddenly, as before under the eaves of the Emmonwheel, Sam saw these two rivals with other vision. A crouching shape, scarcely more than the shadow of a living thing, a creature now wholly ruined and defeated, yet filled with a hideous lust and rage, and before it stood stern, untouchable now by pity, a figure robed in white, but at its breast it held a wheel of fire. Out of the fire there spoke a commanding voice.
"Begone, and trouble me no more. If you touch me ever again, you shall be cast yourself into the fire of doom."
The crouching shape backed away, terror in its blinking eyes, and yet at the same time insatiable desire. Then the vision passed, and Sam saw Frodo standing, hand on breast, his breath coming in great gasps, and Gollum at his feet, resting on his knees with his wide splayed hands upon the ground.
"Look out!" cried Sam. "He'll spring!"
He stepped forward, brandishing his sword.
"Quick, master!" he gasped. "Go on! Go on! No time to lose! I'll deal with him! Go on!"
Frodo looked at him as if at one now far away. "Yes, I must go on," he said. "Farewell, Sam. This is the end at last. On Mount Doom, doom shall fall. Farewell." He turned and went on, walking slowly but erect up the climbing path.
"Now," said Sam. "At last I can deal with you."
He leapt forward with drawn blade, ready for battle. But Gollum did not spring. He fell flat upon the ground and whimpered.
"Don't kill us," he wept. "Don't hurt us with nasty, cruel steel. Let us live, yes, live just a little longer. Lost, lost, we're lost. And when Precious goes, we'll die, yes, die into the dust."
He clawed up the ashes of the path with his long, fleshless fingers.
"Dust," he hissed.
Sam's hand wavered. His mind was hot with wrath and the memory of evil. It would be just to slay this treacherous, murderous creature, just and many times deserved, and also, it seemed, the only safe thing to do. But deep in his heart there was something that restrained him. He couldn't strike this thing lying in the dust, forlorn, ruinous, utterly wretched. He himself, though only for a little while, had borne the ring, and now dimly he guessed the agony of Gollum's shrivelled mind and body, enslaved to that ring, unable to find peace or relief ever in life again. But Sam had no words to express what he felt.
"Oh, curse you, you stinking thing," he said. "Go away, be off. I don't trust you, not as far as I could kick you. But be off, or I shall hurt you, yes, with nasty, cruel steel."
Gollum got up on all fours and backed away for several paces, and then he turned, and as Sam aimed a kick at him, he fled away down the path. Sam gave no more heed to him. He suddenly remembered his master. He looked up the path and could not see him. As fast as he could, he trudged up the road. If he had looked back, he might have seen, not far below, Gollum turn again, and then, with a wild light of madness glaring in his eyes, come, swiftly but warily, creeping on behind, a slinking shadow among the stones. The path climbed on. Soon it bent again, and with a last eastward course, passed in a cutting along the face of the cone, and came to the dark door in the mountainside, the door of the Samarthnaa. The way now rising towards the south, the sun, piercing the smokes and haze, burned ominous, a dull, bleared disk of red. But all Mordor lay about the mountain like a dead land, silent, shadow-folded, waiting for some dreadful stroke. Sam came to the gaping mouth and peered in. It was dark and hot, and a deep rumbling shook the air.
"Frodo! Master!" he called.
There was no answer. For a moment he stood, his heart beating with wild fears, and then he plunged in. A shadow followed him.
"Twice you have borne me, Gwaihir, my friend," said Gandalf. "Thrice shall pay for all, if you're willing. You will not find me a burden much greater than when you bore me from Zirakzigil, where my old life burned away."
"I would bear you," answered Gwaihir, "whether you will, even were you made of stone."
"Then come, and let your brother go with us, and some other of your folk who is most swift, for we have need of speed greater than any wind, outmatching the wings of the Nazgul."
"The north wind blows, but we shall outfly it," said Gwaihir,
and he lifted up Gandalf and sped away south, and with him went Landrevel and Meneldor, young and swift. And they passed over Udun and Gorgoroth, and saw all the land in ruin and tumult beneath them, and before them Mount Doom blazing, pouring out its fire.
"I am glad that you are here with me," said Frodo. "Here at the end of all things, Sam."
"Yes, I'm with you, master," said Sam, laying Frodo's wounded hand gently to his breast. "And you're with me. And the journey's finished. But after coming all that way, I don't want to give up yet. It's not like me, somehow, if you understand."
"Maybe not, Sam," said Frodo. "But it's like things are in the world. Hopes fail, an end comes. We have only a little time to wait now. We're lost in ruin and downfall, and there's no escape."
Well, master, we could at least go further from this dangerous place here, from this crack of doom, if that's its name. Now, couldn't we?
Come, Mr. Frodo, let's go down the path at any rate.
Very well, Sam. If you wish to go, I'll come, said Frodo, and they rose and went slowly down the winding road, and even as they passed towards the mountain's quaking feet, a great smoke and steam belched from the Samathnaur, and the side of the cone was riven open, and a huge fiery vomit rolled in slow, thunderous cascade down the eastern mountainside. Frodo and Sam could go no further. Their last strength of mind and body was swiftly ebbing. They had reached a low, ashen hill piled at the mountain's foot. But from it there was no more escape. It was an island now, not long to endure, amid the torment of Orodruin. All about it the earth gaped, and from deep rifts and pits smoke and fumes leapt up. Behind them the mountain was convulsed. Great rents opened in its side. Slow rivers of fire came down the long slopes towards them. Soon they would be engulfed. A rain of hot ash was falling. They stood now, and Sam, still holding his master's hand, caressed it. He sighed.
"What a tale we've been in, Mr. Frodo, haven't we?" he said. "I wish I could hear it told. Do you think they'll say, 'Now comes the story of Nine-Fingered Frodo and the Ring of Doom,' and then everyone will hush, like we did, when in Rivendell they told us the tale of Beren One-Hand and the Great Jewel? I wish I could hear it, and I wonder how it'll go on after our part."
But even while he spoke so, to keep fear away until the very last, his eyes still strayed north, north into the eye of the wind, to where the sky far off was clear, as the cold blast, rising to a gale, drove back the darkness and the ruin of the clouds. And so it was that Gwaihir saw them, with his keen, far-seeing eyes, as down the wild wind he came, and daring the great peril of the skies he circled in the air. Two small dark figures, forlorn, hand in hand upon a little hill, while the world shook under them, and gasped, and rivers of fire drew near. And even as he espied them, and came swooping down, he saw them fall, worn out, or choked with fumes and heat, or stricken down by despair at last, hiding their eyes from death. Side by side they lay, and down swept Gwaihir, and down came Landrovel and Meneldor the Swift, and in a dream, not knowing what fate had befallen them, the wanderers were lifted up and borne far away out of the darkness and the fire. When Sam awoke, he found that he was lying on some soft bed, but over him gently swayed wide beechen boughs, and through their young leaves sunlight glimmered, green and gold. All the air was full of a sweet mingled scent. He remembered that smell, the fragrance of Ithilien. "Bless me," he mused, "how long have I been asleep?" For the scent had borne him back to the day when he had lit his little fire under the sunny bank, and for a moment all else between was out of waking memory. He stretched and drew a deep breath.
"Why, what a dream I've had," he muttered. "I am glad to wake."
He sat up, and then he saw that Frodo was lying beside him, and slept peacefully, one hand behind his head, and the other resting upon the coverlet. It was the right hand, and the third finger was missing. Full memory flooded back, and Sam cried aloud,
"It wasn't a dream."
"Then where are we?"
And a voice spoke softly behind, "In the land of Ithilien, and in the keeping of the king, and he awaits you." With that Gandalf stood before him, robed in white, his beard now gleaming like pure snow in the twinkling of the leafy sunlight. "Well, Master Samwise, how do you feel?" he said. But Sam lay back, and stared with open mouth, and for a moment, between bewilderment and great joy, he could not answer. At last he gasped,
"Gandalf! I thought you were dead. But then I thought I was dead myself. Is everything sad going to come untrue?
What's happened to the world?
A great shadow has departed, said Gandalf.
And then he laughed, and the sound was like music, or like water in a parched land. And as he listened, the thought came to Sam that he had not heard laughter, the pure sound of merriment, for days upon days without count. It fell upon his ears like the echo of all the joys he had ever known. But he himself burst into tears. Then, as a sweet rain will pass down a wind of spring and the sun will shine out the clearer, his tears ceased, and his laughter welled up, and laughing he sprang from his bed.
"How do I feel?" he cried. "Well, I don't know how to say it. I feel—" he waved his arms in the air. "I feel like spring after winter, and sun on the leaves, and like trumpets and harps and all the songs I've ever heard."
He stopped, and he turned towards his master. "But how's Mr. Frodo?" he said. "Isn't it a shame about his poor hand? But I hope he's all right otherwise. He's had a cruel time."
"Yes, I'm all right otherwise," said Frodo, sitting up and laughing in his turn. "I fell asleep again waiting for you, Sam, you sleepy-head. I was awake early this morning, and now it must be nearly noon."
"Noon?" said Sam, trying to calculate.
"Noon of what day?" "The 14th of the new year," said Gandalf, "or, if you like, the 8th day of April in the Shire Reckoning. But in Gondor the new year will always now begin upon the 25th of March, when Sauron fell. And when you were brought out of the fire to the king, he has tended you, and now he awaits you. You shall eat and drink with him. When you are ready, I will lead you to him."
"The king?" said Sam. "What king? And who is he?"
"The king of Gondor and lord of the western lands," said Gandalf. "And he has taken back all his ancient realm. He will ride soon to his crowning, but he waits for you."
"What shall we wear?"
said Sam, for all he could see was the old and tattered clothes that they had journeyed in, lying folded on the ground beside their beds.
"The clothes that you wore on your way to Mordor," said Gandalf. "Even the orc rags that you bore in the Blackland, Frodo, shall be preserved. No silks and linens, nor any armour or heraldry could be more honourable. But later I will find some other clothes, perhaps."
Then he held out his hands to them, and they saw that one shone with light.
"What have you got there?" Frodo cried. "Can it be—"
"Yes, I brought your two treasures. They were found on Sam when you were rescued. The Lady Galadriel's gifts. Your glass, Frodo, and your box, Sam. You will be glad to have these safe again."
When they were washed and clad, and had eaten a light meal, the hobbits followed Gandalf. They stepped out of the beech grove in which they had lain, and passed on to a long green lawn, glowing in sunshine, bordered by stately dark-leaved trees laden with scarlet blossom. Behind them they could hear the sound of falling water, and a stream ran down before them between flowering banks, until it came to a green wood at the lawn's foot, and passed then on under an archway of trees, through which they saw the shimmer of water far away. As they came to the opening in the wood, they were surprised to see knights in bright mail and tall guards in silver and black standing there, who greeted them with honour and bowed before them. And then one blew a long trumpet, and they went on through the aisle of trees beside the singing stream. So they came to a wide green land, and beyond it was a broad river in a silver haze, out of which rose a long wooded isle, and many ships lay by its shores. But on the field where they now stood, a great host was drawn up, in ranks and companies glittering in the sun. And as the hobbits approached, swords were unsheathed, and spears were shaken, and horns and trumpets sang, and men cried with many voices and in many tongues, "Long live the halflings! Praise them with great praise! Cuyo I feriain anan, Anglan I ferianath! Praise them with great praise, Frodo and Samwise! Dara behail, Conin and Anrun! Eglerio, praise them, Eglerio! Ah, light a te, light a te! Andave, light of Almet!
praise them. Corma Colindor, Alaita Tariena, praise them, the ring-bearers, praise them with great praise.
And so the red blood blushing in their faces and their eyes shining with wonder, Frodo and Sam went forward and saw that amidst the clamorous host were set three high seats built of green turves. Behind the seat upon the right floated, white on green, a great horse running free. Upon the left was a banner, silver upon blue, a ship swan-proud faring on the sea. But behind the highest throne in the midst of all, a great standard was spread in the breeze, and there a white tree flowered upon a sable field beneath a shining crown and seven glittering stars. On the throne sat a mail-clad man. A great sword was laid across his knees, but he wore no helm. As they drew near, he rose. And then they knew him, changed as he was, so high and glad of face, kingly, lord of men, dark-haired with eyes of grey. Frodo ran to meet him, and Sam followed close behind.
"Well, if that isn't the crown of all," he said. "Strider, or I'm still asleep."
"Yes, Sam, Strider," said Aragorn. "It is a long way, is it not, from Bree, where you did not like the look of me? A long way for us all, but yours has been the darkest road."
And then, to Sam's surprise and utter confusion, he bowed his knee before them. And taking them by the hand, Frodo upon his right and Sam upon his left, he led them to the throne, and setting them upon it, he turned to the men and captains who stood by and spoke, so that his voice rang over all the host, crying,
"Praise them with great praise!"
And when the glad shout had swelled up and died away again, to Sam's final and complete satisfaction and pure joy, a minstrel of Gondor stood forth and knelt and begged leave to sing. And behold, he said,
"Lo, lords and knights and men of valour unashamed, kings and princes, and fair people of Gondor, and riders of Rohan, and ye sons of Elrond, and Dúnadan of the North, and Elf and Dwarf, and Great Hearts of the Shire, and all free folk of the West, now listen to my lay, for I will sing to you of Frodo of the Nine Fingers and the Ring of Doom."
And when Sam heard that, he laughed aloud for sheer delight, and he stood up and cried,
"O great glory and splendour, and all my wishes have come true!"
And then he wept. And all the host laughed and wept, and in the midst of their merriment and tears, the clear voice of the minstrel rose like silver and gold, and all men were hushed. And he sang to them, now in the elven tongue, now in the speech of the West, until their hearts, wounded with sweet words, overflowed, and their joy was like swords, and they passed in thought out to regions where pain and delight flow together, and tears are the very wine of blessedness. And at the last, as the sun fell from the noon and the shadows of the trees lengthened, he ended.
"Praise them with great praise," he said, and knelt.
And then Aragorn stood up, and all the host arose, and they passed to pavilions made ready, to eat and drink and make merry while the day lasted. Frodo and Sam were led apart and brought to a tent, and there their old raiment was taken off, but folded and set aside with honour, and clean linen was given to them. Then Gandalf came, and in his arms, to the wonder of Frodo, he bore the sword and the elven cloak and the mithril coat that had been taken from him in Mordor. For Sam he brought a coat of gilded mail, and his elven cloak all healed of the soils and hurts that it had suffered. And then he laid before them two swords. "I do not wish for any sword," said Frodo.
"Tonight at least you should wear one," said Gandalf.
Then Frodo took the small sword that had belonged to Sam, and had been laid at his side in Cirith Ungol. "Sting I gave to you, Sam," he said.
"No, master. Mr. Bilbo gave it to you, and it goes with his silver coat. He wouldn't wish anyone else to wear it now."
Frodo gave way,
and Gandalf, as if he were their esquire, knelt and girt the sword belts about them, and then rising he set circlets of silver upon their heads. And when they were arrayed, they went to the great feast, and they sat at the king's table with Gandalf, and King Éomer of Rohan, and the Prince Imrahil, and all the chief captains, and there also were Gimli and Legolas. But when, after the standing silence, wine was brought, there came in two esquires to serve the kings, or so they seemed to be. One was clad in the silver and sable of the guards of Minas Tirith, and the other in white and green. But Sam wondered what such young boys were doing in an army of mighty men. Then suddenly, as they drew near, and he could see them plainly, he exclaimed, "Why, look, Mr. Frodo! Look here! Well, if it isn't Pippin! Mr. Peregrine Took, I should say, and Mr. Merry! How they've grown, bless me! But I can see there's more tales to tell than ours." "There are indeed," said Pippin, turning towards him, "and we'll begin telling them as soon as this feast is ended. In the meantime, you can try Gandalf. He's not so close as he used to be, though he laughs now more than he talks. For the present, Merry and I are busy. We're knights of the city and of the mark, as I hope you observe." At last the glad day ended, and when the sun was gone and the round moon rode slowly above the mists of Anduin and flickered through the fluttering leaves, Frodo and Sam sat under the whispering trees amid the fragrance of fair Ithilien, and they talked deep into the night with Merry and Pippin and Gandalf, and after a while Legolas and Gimli joined them. There Frodo and Sam learned much of all that had happened to the company after their fellowship was broken on the evil day at Parth Galan by Rauros Falls, and still there was always more to ask and more to tell. Orcs and talking trees and leagues of grass and galloping riders and glittering caves and white towers and golden halls and battles and tall ships sailing, all these passed before Sam's mind until he felt bewildered. But amidst all these wonders he returned again to his astonishment at the size of Merry and Pippin, and he made them stand back to back with Frodo and himself. He scratched his head. "Can't understand it at your age," he said. "But there it is. You're 3 inches taller than you ought to be, or I'm a dwarf."
"That you certainly are not," said Gimli. "But what did I say? Mortals cannot go drinking ent draughts and expect no more to come of them than a pot of beer."
"Ent draughts?" said Sam. "There you go about ents again, but what they are beats me. Why, it'll take weeks before we get all these things sized up." "Weeks indeed," said Pippin. "And then Frodo will have to be locked up in a tower in Minas Tirith and write it all down. Otherwise he'll forget half of it, and poor old Bilbo will be dreadfully disappointed."
At length Gandalf rose. "The hands of the king are hands of healing, dear friends," he said. "But he went to the very brink of death ere he recalled you, putting forth all his power, and sent you into the sweet forgetfulness of sleep. And though you have indeed slept long and blessedly, still it is now time to sleep again."
"And not only Sam and Frodo here," said Gimli, "but you too, Pippin. I love you, if only because of the pains you've cost me, which I shall never forget, nor shall I forget finding you on the hill of the last battle. But for Gimli the dwarf you would have been lost then. But at least I know now the look of a hobbit's foot, though it be all that can be seen under a heap of bodies. And when I heaved that great carcass off, I made sure you were dead. I could have torn out my beard. And it's only a day yet since you were first up and abroad again. To bed now you go, and so shall I."
"And I," said Legolas, "shall walk in the woods of this fair land, which is rest enough. In days to come, if my elven lord allows, some of our folk shall remove hither, and when we come it shall be blessed for a while. For a while, a month, a life, 100 years of men. But Anduin is near, and Anduin leads down to the sea, to the sea."
to the sea, the white gulls are crying. The wind is blowing, and the white foam is flying. West, west, away, the round sun is falling. Grey ship, do you hear them calling? The voices of my people that have gone before me. I will leave the woods that bore me. For our days are ending, and our years failing. I will pass the wide waters, lonely sailing. Long are the waves on the last shore falling. Sweet are the voices in the lost isle calling. In Eressëa, in elven home that no man can discover, where the leaves fall not, land of my people forever.
And so singing, Legolas went away down the hill. Then the others also departed, and Frodo and Sam went to their beds and slept. And in the morning they rose again in hope and peace, and they spent many days in Ithilien. For the field of Cormallan, where the host was now encamped, was near to Heneth Annwn, and the stream that flowed from its falls could be heard in the night as it rushed down through its rocky gate and passed through the flowery meads into the tides of Anduin by the isle of Caer Andros. The hobbits wandered here and there, visiting again the places that they had passed before, and Sam hoped always in some shadow of the woods or secret glade to catch, maybe, a glimpse of the great Olifaunt. And when he learned that at the siege of Gondor there had been a great number of these beasts, but that they were all destroyed, he thought it a sad loss. "Well, one can't be everywhere at once, I suppose," he said. "But I missed a lot, seemingly." In the meanwhile, the host made ready for the return to Minas Tirith. The weary rested, and the hurt were healed. For some had laboured and fought much with the remnants of the Easterlings and Southrons until all were subdued. And latest of all, those returned who had passed into Mordor and destroyed the fortresses in the north of the land. But at the last, when the month of May was drawing near, the captains of the West set out again. And they went aboard ship with all their men, and they sailed from Caer Andros down Anduin to Osgiliath. And there they remained for one day. And the day after, they came to the green fields of the Pelennor, and saw again the white towers under tall Myndolwyn, the city of the men of Gondor, last memory of Westerness, that had passed through the darkness and fire to a new day. And there, in the midst of the fields, they set up their pavilions and awaited the morning. For it was the eve of May, and the king would enter his gates with the rising of the sun.
This ends Disc 9.
At first he could see nothing. In his great need he drew out once more the phial of Galadriel, but it was pale and cold in his trembling hand, and threw no light into that stifling dark. He was come to the heart of the realm of Sauron, and the forges of his ancient might, greatest in Middle-earth. All other powers were here subdued. Fearfully he took a few uncertain steps in the dark, and then all at once there came a flash of red that leapt upwards and smote the high black roof. Then Sam saw that he was in a long cave or tunnel that bored into the mountain's smoking cone.
But only a short way ahead, its floor and the walls on either side were cloven by a great fissure, out of which the red glare came, now leaping up, now dying down into darkness. And all the while, far below, there was a rumour and a trouble, as of great engines throbbing and labouring. The light sprang up again, and there, on the brink of the chasm, at the very crack of doom, stood Frodo, black against the glare, tense, erect, but still as if he had been turned to stone. "Master!" cried Sam. Then Frodo stirred and spoke with a clear voice, indeed with a voice clearer and more powerful than Sam had ever heard him use, and it rose above the throb and turmoil of Mount Doom, ringing in the roof and walls. "I have come," he said, "but I do not choose now to do what I came to do. I will not do this deed. The ring is mine!" And suddenly, as he set it on his finger, he vanished from Sam's sight. Sam gasped, but he had no chance to cry out, for at that moment many things happened. Something struck Sam violently in the back. His legs were knocked from under him, and he was flung aside, striking his head against the stony floor, as a dark shape sprang over him. He lay still, and for a moment all went black. And far away, as Frodo put on the ring and claimed it for his own, even in Samothnawr, the very heart of his realm, the power in Barad-dûr was shaken, and the tower trembled from its foundations to its proud and bitter crown. The Dark Lord was suddenly aware of him, and his eye, piercing all shadows, looked across the plain to the door that he had made, and the magnitude of his own folly was revealed to him in a blinding flash, and all the devices of his enemies were at last laid bare. Then his wrath blazed in consuming flame, but his fear rose like a vast black smoke to choke him, for he knew his deadly peril and the thread upon which his doom now hung. From all his policies and webs of fear and treachery, from all his stratagems and wars, his mind shook free, and throughout his realm a tremor ran. His slaves quailed, and his armies halted, and his captains, suddenly steerless, bereft of will, wavered and despaired, for they were forgotten. The whole mind and purpose of the power that wielded them was now bent with overwhelming force upon the mountain. At his summons, wheeling with a rending cry, in a last desperate race there flew, faster than the winds, the Nazgûl, the Ringwraiths, and with a storm of wings they hurtled southwards to Mount Doom. Sam got up. He was dazed, and blood, streaming from his head, dripped in his eyes. He groped forward, and then he saw a strange and terrible thing. Gollum, on the edge of the abyss, was fighting like a mad thing with an unseen foe. To and fro he swayed, now so near the brink that almost he tumbled in, now dragging back, falling to the ground, rising and falling again. And all the while he hissed, but spoke no words. The fires below awoke in anger. The red light blazed, and all the cavern was filled with a great glare and heat. Suddenly Sam saw Gollum's long hands draw upwards to his mouth. His white fangs gleamed, and then snapped as they bit. Frodo gave a cry, and there he was, fallen upon his knees at the chasm's edge. But Gollum, dancing like a mad thing, held aloft the ring, a finger still thrust within its circle. It shone now as if verily it was wrought of living fire.
"Precious! Precious! Precious!"
Gollum cried.
"My precious! Oh, my precious!"
And with that, even as his eyes were lifted up to gloat on his prize, he stepped too far, toppled, wavered for a moment on the brink, and then with a shriek he fell. Out of the depths came his last wail,
"Precious!"
And he was gone. There was a roar and a great confusion of noise. Fires leapt up and licked the roof.
The throbbing grew to a great tumult, and the mountain shook. Sam ran to Frodo and picked him up and carried him out to the door. And there upon the dark threshold of the Samathnaur, high above the plains of Mordor, such wonder and terror came on him that he stood still, forgetting all else, and gazed as one turned to stone. A brief vision he had of swirling cloud, and in the midst of it, towers and battlements, tall as hills, founded upon a mighty mountain throne above immeasurable pits, great courts and dungeons, eyeless prisons, sheer as cliffs, and gaping gates of steel and adamant. And then all passed. Towers fell and mountains slid, walls crumbled and melted, crashing down. Vast spires of smoke and spouting steams went billowing up, up, until they toppled like an overwhelming wave, and its wild crest curled and came foaming down upon the land. And then at last, over the miles between, there came a rumble, rising to a deafening crash and roar. The earth shook, the plain heaved and cracked, and Orodruin reeled. Fire belched from its riven summit. The skies burst into thunder, seared with lightning. Down like lashing whips fell a torrent of black rain, and into the heart of the storm, with a cry that pierced all other sounds, tearing the clouds asunder, the Nazgul came, shooting like flaming bolts, as caught in the fiery ruin of hill and sky they crackled, withered, and went out.
"Well, this is the end, Sam Gamgee," said a voice by his side. And there was Frodo, pale and worn, and yet himself again. And in his eyes there was peace now, neither strain of will, nor madness, nor any fear. His burden was taken away. There was the dear master of the sweeter days and the Shire.
"Master!" cried Sam, and fell upon his knees. In all that ruin of the world, for the moment he felt only joy, great joy. The burden was gone. His master had been saved. He was himself again. He was free. And then Sam caught sight of the maimed and bleeding hand.
"Your poor hand," he said, "and I have nothing to bind it with or comfort it. I would have spared him a whole hand of mine rather. But he's gone now, beyond recall, gone forever."
"Yes," said Frodo. "But do you remember Gandalf's words? Even Gollum may have something yet to do. But for him, Sam, I could not have destroyed the ring. The quest would have been in vain, even at the bitter end. So let us forgive him, for the quest is achieved, and now all is over. I am glad you're here with me, here at the end of all things, Sam."
Chapter 4. The Field of Cormallen. All about the hills the hosts of Mordor raged. The captains of the west were foundering in a gathering sea. The sun gleamed red, and under the wings of the Nazgul the shadows of death fell dark upon the earth. Aragorn stood beneath his banner, silent and stern, as one lost in thought of things long past or far away, but his eyes gleamed like stars that shine the brighter as the night deepens. Upon the hilltop stood Gandalf, and he was white and cold, and no shadow fell on him. The onslaught of Mordor broke like a wave on the beleaguered hills, voices roaring like a tide amid the wreck and crash of arms. As if to his eyes some sudden vision had been given, Gandalf stirred, and he turned, looking back north where the skies were pale and clear. Then he lifted up his hands and cried in a loud voice, ringing above the din,
"The eagles are coming!"
And many voices answered, crying,
"The eagles are coming! The eagles are coming!"
The hosts of Mordor looked up and wondered what this sign might mean. There came Gwaihir the Windlord, and Landreval his brother, greatest of all the eagles of the north, mightiest of the descendants of old Thorondor, who built his eyries in the inaccessible peaks of the encircling mountains when Middle-earth was young. Behind them, in long, swift lines, came all their vassals from the northern mountains, speeding on a gathering wind. Straight down upon the Nazgul they bore, stooping suddenly out of the high airs, and the rush of their wide wings as they passed over was like a gale. But the Nazgul turned and fled, and vanished into Mordor's shadows, hearing a sudden, terrible call out of the dark tower. And even at that moment all the hosts of Mordor trembled. Doubt clutched their hearts, their laughter failed, their hands shook and their limbs were loosed. The power that drove them on and filled them with hate and fury was wavering. Its will was removed from them, and now, looking in the eyes of their enemies, they saw a deadly light and were afraid. Then all the captains of the West cried aloud, for their hearts were filled with a new hope in the midst of darkness. Out from the beleaguered hills, knights of Gondor, riders of Rohan, Dúnedain of the North, close-serried companies, drove against their wavering foes, piercing the press with a thrust of bitter spears. But Gandalf lifted up his arms and called once more in a clear voice, "Stand, men of the West, stand and wait. This is the hour of doom." And even as he spoke, the earth rocked beneath their feet. Then, rising swiftly up, far above the towers of the Black Gate, high above the mountains, a vast soaring darkness sprang into the sky, flickering with fire. The earth groaned and quaked. The towers of the Teeth swayed, tottered, and fell down. The mighty rampart crumbled. The Black Gate was hurled in ruin. And from far away, now dim, now growing, now mounting to the clouds, there came a drumming rumble, a roar, a long echoing roll of ruinous noise. "The realm of Sauron is ended," said Gandalf. "The Ring-Bearer has fulfilled his quest." And as the captains gazed south to the land of Mordor, it seemed to them that, black against the pall of cloud, there rose a huge shape of shadow, impenetrable, lightning-crowned, filling all the sky. Enormous it reared above the world, and stretched out towards them a vast threatening hand, terrible but impotent, for even as it leaned over them, a great wind took it, and it was all blown away and passed. And then a hush fell. The captains bowed their heads, and when they looked up again, behold, their enemies were flying, and the power of Mordor was scattering like dust in the wind, as when death smites the swollen, brooding thing that inhabits their crawling hill and holds them all in sway. Ants will wander witless and purposeless and then feebly die. So the creatures of Sauron, orc or troll or beast spell-enslaved, ran hither and thither mindless, and some slew themselves, or cast themselves in pits, or fled wailing back to hide in holes and dark, lightless places far from hope. But the men of Rûn and of Harad, Easterling and Southron, saw the ruin of their war and the great majesty and glory of the captains of the West. And those that were deepest and longest in evil servitude, hating the West, and yet were men proud and bold, in their turn now gathered themselves for a last stand of desperate battle. But the most part fled eastward as they could, and some cast their weapons down and sued for mercy. Then Gandalf, leaving all such matters of battle and command to Aragorn and the other lords, stood upon the hilltop and called, and down to him came the great eagle, Gwaihir the Windlord, and stood before him.